In Matthew 6 tonight, before we do that, I want you to look back at chapter 5 and verse 20, this section that John took us through a few weeks ago. And I want to go back here because I think that the idea in chapter 5 and verse 20 is continuing to run through what we're studying. And so I want us to be sure and watch for this thematic thread that Jesus is using in some different ways as we move into chapter 6. So remember, chapter 5 and verse 20, Jesus tells us that our righteousness is supposed to surpass the righteousness of the Pharisees, right? And so we spent some time talking about that last week, and let's see what you retained. Or if we need to go back and work it again. What does it mean, what does he mean, when Jesus said, you got to have a greater righteousness than the Pharisees? What's he talking about?
It's more than outward appearance, it's also a matter of the heart.
Yes, thank you.
Outside versus inside.
Man, thank you for not breaking my heart, because I was really worried y'all would all stare blankly at me at this point. So I'm going to put these two words back on the board, because we worked on them for a while. Jesus is not saying that we need to do a better job of checking the boxes than the Pharisees, right? They were concerned with how things looked on the outside, outwardly, right? They wanted to present themselves as being pious and religious. But for the Pharisees, that's just a facade. That's not what they were like inwardly. Right? Their hearts were often, in fact, corrupt, which is why you had them doing some rather bizarre things, like making a vow to do something, but only feeling obligated to keep the vow if they actually invoked the name of God. If they didn't invoke the name of God, what could they do? Yes, which tells you what about them inwardly?
Not people of their word.
Yes, yes. They're not honest people. They're corrupt people. So outwardly, they wanted to present as being very pious, but inwardly, that's not who they were at all. And so we kind of worked on that a little bit last week, that what Jesus is not interested in is people who are just going to do a better job of checking the boxes or to figure out more boxes to check or anything like that. What he's working in the sermon is this idea that if you will be in the heart devoted to me, then the outward stuff is going to take care of itself. Do you see the difference? It's a whole different kind of righteousness. Now, what I would like to suggest, if you'll turn over to chapter 6 now, we're going to work the first 18 verses tonight. This is where he gets into this conversation about giving to the poor and praying and fasting. I want to suggest that Jesus is still working this same idea from a little bit different direction now, but he's still essentially making the same point. That I am concerned first about what you are in your heart, and if you get that right, then the outside will take care of itself. So let me ask you a question. Looking down through this, hopefully you read it before class. If you did, can you see a connection between these two ideas? This focus on being right in your heart, right? Working its way into what he now says about prayer and giving and those things. You see a connection? Yes. He does talk about that, the many words, just a bunch of words as opposed to being from the heart. Do you see any other connections between this struggle for the outward and the inner?
Well, this is talking about being seen of men and not being pleasing to God. I mean, it's the doing things to be seen, to be noticed, to be pointed out as pious and righteous is what's important, not actually how you feel about any.
Okay, so let's jump on that by looking at the very first verse. Are you in chapter 6? Verse 1, as I work this section, seemed to be almost like a thesis statement. Like, okay, here's how I'm going to work this new angle, and let me lay out where I'm going with this. Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. Now, I think that's kind of the big idea that he's going to work now. And I want to spend some time sort of exploring that, and then we'll go through the text, because I think the big idea just makes the text make sense to us when we understand that. So in verse 1, when Jesus says, when he talks about practicing your righteousness before men, is that outward or inner? What's he talking about? Yeah, that's exactly right. It's what you do before men. Doing things that men see, like praying and giving. When you practice your righteousness before men, what's the warning? Look back at verse 1. No. That's the context. What's the warning?
What? Beware that you're doing that. Don't do it.
Ah, now where's he looking? And what's he analyzing?
Motive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Man, I'm just going to stop class because y'all are doing so great. I don't even want to go any further. Y'all got it down, right? Now he's looking. Up here he's looking at our actions, what we do, how we behave. But then he moves on to say, but what's underneath the actions? Why are you doing the things that you're doing? Okay, so that's interesting you bring that up. And it's actually in my notes, but in the future. But I'll run this with you a little bit. And if I get lost and confused tonight, y'all can just blame Troy. I think that actually what he's doing in this segment is very similar to what he was doing in the last segment, right? We're still talking about the difference between the outer and the inner, right? Your heart versus your actions. But the actions at the end of chapter 5 were all wicked, right? Things like insulting people, driven by a heart of hatred, and adultery, driven by a heart full of lust, and dishonest dealings, you know, not keeping your vows, you know, driven by a heart that wanted to take advantage of people. That was all negative. And now what he does here at the beginning of 6 is he flips that around, and he talks about things that in and of themselves are what? These are good things. So this isn't about avoiding adultery or vow breaking or whatever. This is about the righteous things we did. And so what I think he does here is he actually explores a whole new level of righteousness. So it isn't just about not doing bad stuff. It's also about doing good stuff. Finish the sentence for me. For the right reason. So another thing we have to ponder is the dreadful possibility that we may be doing the right things and God still isn't pleased with us because, yeah, the motive isn't right. So this whole outward, inward thing, really, really a big deal. I think the question being explored here, I'm going to try to get back on my notes now. We'll see if this works. Thank you. Appreciate that. I think the question being explored here is why do we do the things that we do? Even the things that we do that are religious, works of righteousness, as he would describe it. Why do we do the things that we do? Is it to be noticed and to be praised by men? Or is it because we're interested in being noticed and receiving God's approval? It strikes me that particularly in this time, that's a really good question to ask. You know why I would say that? I think we have a disease in our culture that makes this a really important question to ask. Who said Facebook? Why did you say Facebook? That is so interesting. Run with that. We have invented a whole new version of photography that is about noticing me. What's it called? Okay, those of you who are over 40, do you remember that ever?
To be fair,
I did try to take pictures of myself with a camera before when you had to like turn it around and say, all right, am I looking straight into this thing? You know,
I'm sorry, Van Gogh painted like 50 pictures of himself.
Okay, but yeah, but he was a nut. He doesn't count.
I'm just saying, artists have always painted themselves. There's like a whole website.
Yeah, but people haven't run around, you know, falling off cliffs trying to photograph themselves.
So. I 100% agree.
Yeah. And then the other thing with your social media posts, what's everybody looking for? Yes. And come on, don't raise your hand and admit it, but you've posted something and you've looked down and like two people liked it. And you were? Like, what's wrong with these people? All my friends are on vacation and they have no internet service. That has to be what's going on. It's all about likes and selfies, and we're all about having people's approval. And so I just, as I'm going through this and thinking about this, I'm thinking, what an important time for us to really ponder why we do the things we do. In this context, am I looking for people to notice me and give me a thumbs up? Or is this about God and giving Him honor and glory? Yes, and I'm really surprised you've held back. Go ahead. So that's a great question, and obviously you have influenced others in the class, because that's, I have that written down, just like two more points down on the page. But hey, we'll run that one too in advance. That's a really great question of how you square, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works in 5, and then the Lord turns right around in 6 and said, dude, you ought to be in your closet. Don't let anybody see that. How do you square those two things? What's that? Now what are we back to? What's going on the inside? What is the motive back? So go back to 5:16. Let your light shine before men in such a way, finish it, that they may see your good works. The motive of the Christian's light and salt is to bring glory to God, right? Now come to chapter 6. What is the motive of the bad guy, the hypocrite in 6? Yeah, it's about people noticing me. And so I think actually it plays right into this thematic thread Jesus is working. It's exactly the point. This is supposed to, he's looking at what's inside it in the heart and saying, if the motive is true, let me say it this way. There is a difference between doing things that are seen by men and doing things to be seen by men. Makes sense? Yeah, I'm sorry. I've just been cutting you off.
Don't you think the privacy part of this kind of relates back to the pluck out your eye, cut off your hand kind of thing? I mean, this is the extreme version. If you can't pray in public without doing it for the wrong reasons, then you need to do it privately in your closet. You know, if you can't give to the poor without letting everybody know, then you have to be, I mean, I think this is just an extreme.
So I think that because we still wrestle with these two things, that sometimes we read the sermons and we almost become like a Pharisee when we read the sermon, right? So I told y'all last week that when I was growing up, one of the big debates among brethren is, okay, Jesus said no vow. Can I take a vow in court? It was a big struggle among Christians. And I think that misses the point. And I think, too, if we were to come back and say, okay, so wait. How can we have assembly prayers if all our prayers are supposed to be in the closet? If it's supposed to be in the closet, I mean, could I pray in the living room? What if I close the blinds? Is that kind of the same? I think we are almost becoming Pharisaic in our processing of it this way. It's not box checking. It's motive analyzing. Do you see the difference? And the point is, the whole line about going in your closet means I'm not trying to be a spectacle, right? I'm not trying to get people to notice me. I'm trying to have a conversation with God. So yes, I think that's exactly right. I don't know if I would call it hyperbole or not. I do think he uses that some in the sermon, but I certainly think that he is not making a point about identifying the box check location as much as he's saying, your spirit needs to be, I'm not doing this to put on a show for people. And I think in this time, that's culture. This is a big deal. I think it's a big struggle for us. Okay? Let me talk about one of the words. I'm sorry, did I miss a hand? I want to talk about one other thing, and I totally don't know where I am in my notes anymore, but that's okay. I'm rolling with you tonight. I want to talk about the use of the term hypocrite in here, because he uses that term three times. Did y'all pick up on that? As he goes through his examples, verse 2, do not sound the trumpet before you as the hypocrites do. And then again in verse 5, when you pray, you are not to be like the hypocrites. And then finally, verse 16, do not put on a gloomy face as do the hypocrites. So three times he talks about the wrong motive people as being hypocrites. Let's just throw that up here. So tell me what a hypocrite is. So actually, I'm loath to play with the language because I don't know the original languages, but the root idea, I have read this too, was that a hypocrite was an actor, someone who's playing a role. Masking who you really are. Okay, somebody else. What's a hypocrite? Why do you say that?
Because he knows what he's doing when he does it. He knows he's trying to be presenting something that's not true, but making it intentionally sound as true.
Liar because he knows what he is doing.
Most of these people will claim to be something outwardly, like verbally or whatever, outwardly. But then it turns around. They're just the opposite.
So let's analyze that a little bit, because you're opening up kind of the can of worms that I want to kind of spill out on the table a little bit about this word. Because I am a firm believer that the vast majority of the time we misuse the word hypocrite. Are you a hypocrite if your life is inconsistent with your claim? I claim to be a Christian, but in my life there are things that are inconsistent with the claim. Are you a hypocrite if your life is inconsistent with your claim? Okay. So when we get into this world of claim and conduct, right? Claim and conduct. First of all, is anybody innocent? Because if you are, y'all can just go home. That's done. You get released early from class, right? We all struggle with that sometimes, right? Like we did today. Struggled with what we believe about Jesus in the Bible lining up with how I'm behaving myself in any given moment, right? But there are lots of reasons that's true. Sometimes people struggle with the claim and conduct thing because they are a hypocrite. All right, that's hypocrite. I got to stop and think about this. If I do that at the end, it means I've forgotten how to spell it off the top of my head. Sometimes that's the reason. If in your heart you aren't really devoted to Jesus, then yeah, there's going to be problems between what you say and what you do. And that's what they saw with the Pharisees. But is that the only reason that claim and conduct doesn't always line up? Give me some other ones. Is he texting you? Hi, John.
He says you're a hypocrite if your life is consistently inconsistent.
Consistent inconsistency. I like that. Nicely done. But are there other explanations?
You know, like me, I was raised Catholic, so there's still some things that I'm learning. So
I'm going to use a word, but please, some people... Some people are spiritually immature. What? Well, take a person from the world who knows nothing at all about the Bible, grew up in forget growing up in another religion, grew up in a non-church growing home, and they're converted to Jesus. How much do they know the day they're converted?
Enough to be
a Christian, hopefully, right? But after that, you know, maybe they've got a really hot temper. Where does that fall in the pre-conversion lessons, controlling your temper? I don't teach people that before they're baptized. I don't even know that's a problem before they're baptized. So they may go to work and behave badly 6 months later because they haven't really learned yet. Does that mean they're not inwardly devoted to God? No, it just means that they're still growing. And even for people who have grown, sometimes we are just weak, right? Some of us have been a Christian a long, 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 long time. It'd be interesting to see who's been. No, I won't do that to you. That's just totally not fair. Decades, right?
My granddad still says he's learning.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, is anybody done? Like, y'all, you've got it all nailed down and you don't have to work on anything else as a Christian?
You have a blind spot. You just don't see it in yourself.
Ooh. Ooh, yes. There was like a whole sermon on that recently. Sometimes I have blind spots. I can spell blind spots, by the way, real easy. So my point about that is we really need to be careful with the word hypocrite. I think what John said is right. Hypocrites are consistently inconsistent, but let's go back to the reason why. A hypocrite is a hypocrite because inwardly he's not devoted to Jesus. His heart is not there. That was the problem with the Pharisees. They were determined, for example, to take advantage of people, which is why they messed around with their vows. Outwardly they may have appeared righteous, but they weren't. Inwardly they corrupt. Here's the bizarre thing. You may have someone who outwardly appears to be doing all the right things, and that person actually may be the hypocrite. And here's another guy that's stumbling and failing and has all kinds of blunders, and he may be the genuine disciple. Think about that. So all I'm saying is be very careful about this word. I think sometimes anytime conduct doesn't match claim, we assume someone is a hypocrite. And the vast majority of the time, that's not true. It's just all of us struggling. Yes?
Kind of, I think of Paul calling out Peter as a hypocrite, competing with the Gentiles.
Galatians 2. Yes. Yeah. Now, Paul's a great example of that. Was Peter a hypocrite in Galatians 2?
He was being a hypocrite in that one situation. He was tempted.
I'm going to disagree with you.
He
I think he's a good guy on the inside. I think Peter had weaknesses under pressure. How many colossal failures and stumbles did this guy have when he's under pressure? I think he was weak there. Not a fake. He wasn't acting. See what I'm saying? So I think hypocrite's a very special word devoted to folks who aren't genuine on the inside.
Certain actions can be hypocritical, and you might still not really be
a hypocrite.
Living a life of a hypocrite.
You're not acting. A lot of us are, here it is, a lot of us are trying, not acting. See the difference between those two things? Yes.
And that's what Jesus said. The answer to the
That's what the person with a good heart that wants to please Jesus does. Okay? So let's go back to chapter 6 and what Jesus is going to do is he's going to give us three examples now of the principle we've just laid out, which is really familiar because that's what he did at the end of chapter 5, right? He gave us that call to a higher righteousness, and then he said, let me show you six ways that works, right? And then we get into chapter 6, and he says, let me up that a notch, not just in avoiding evil behavior, but in the good that you do. Make sure that the goodness is flowing from a heart truly devoted to me, and there's not some bad motive driving that. So three things he's going to cover. Give me the list here. What are they? He's going to talk about what first? He's going to do giving, praying, and then he's really going to spend a lot of time on praying, and then fasting. Okay? So those are going to be his three examples that he's going to use to illustrate his point. And I think there's sort of a pattern. I noticed when I was reading this that it just kind of follows the same structure with each of these. Do you see that? What's the first thing? After identifying the topic, what's the first thing that he does? Don't be like the hypocrites, right? So here's the wrong way to do it, and he talks about that, and then what does he go on to do?
Then he gives you the right choice.
Yes, that's exactly right. Then he gives instruction, this is the way I want you to do it, right? So, does that ring familiar? What did he do back in chapter 5? Do you remember? Isn't it the same thing? I know it's structured, or it sounds a little differently. I think essentially the structure is the same. He goes back and says, okay, you've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemies. He took some way the law was misunderstood. So this is what you've heard. This is what I want you to do. And it just seems to me that's exactly what he's doing here. He's just kind of continue along that same pattern. So let's walk through this together and see what he says. Beginning in chapter 6, verse 2, starting with giving. So when you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so they may be honored by men. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. But when you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving will be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret, sees what is done in secret, will reward you. So what do the hypocrites do when they give? That was exactly my question too. We wouldn't put it past them, right? And so there actually isn't any historical evidence that they actually had someone blow a horn to call attention to their giving. Yeah. Look at me working at the soup kitchen on Thanksgiving Day. Let me post this. That's a little close to home, doesn't it? Actually, I think we have language very similar to this. We talk about people doing what when they're bragging on themselves? Yes. In fact, now I'm wondering if maybe whoever said that was thinking about Matthew chapter 6. Maybe there is a connection between those two things. Why did they sound the trumpet? What's their goal? Yeah, so think this through. When they give to the poor, were they really serving the poor? No.
That was not their purpose.
It was
a vehicle for self-promotion.
It was a vehicle. Thank you. That's a great way to say it. It's a vehicle for self-promotion. So, inwardly, the motive, here we go, David, the motive, they were lying about what was really going on. They want you to think, my concern is with the poor and caring for the poor, right? When in reality, they just wanted people to notice and give their approval. Make sense? Yes?
I think they could probably have both motives, but the one that's overwhelmingly on top is the self-promotion.
You know?
But I think that they doesn't mean that they didn't want to do that. It just means that they wanted the glory of doing it.
I suppose it would be fair to say that there could even be degrees, right? I'm not unconcerned about the poor, but I'm more concerned about me. And maybe someone who was just completely concerned about me and didn't care about the poor. I guess, it could be different in every heart, couldn't it? In fact, is this stirring up your memories to a Bible story as we talk about this? I thought about Acts 5. I thought about Ananias and Sapphira. And I don't know what level of care they had for the poor. I just know they cared about what? Yes. And in fact, I think they wanted it known, not just that they gave some money, but we're giving all. See how unselfish we are? There's David. Man, that just keeps coming back up. That idea of perpetrating this lie. What does Jesus say about that? So one of the repeated phrases that the Lord uses is, they have their reward in full. So let's stir that a little bit. What does that mean? Does it mean they won't be getting one? They do get something. They get what they want. People will notice and heap their praise on them. And what Jesus says is, yes, and that's all that they will get, right? So,
it's like the widow and the two mites.
Yeah, nobody thought she was doing anything of consequence, did they? And Jesus' reaction to that, remember what he said about the widow with two mites? She did more than everybody did. Most dramatic giver we have on the scene today. So the scary thing to me when I read this is that it is possible for us to do righteous works and to have people, when we're done, high-five us and say, David, it was so great. And to have God saying, that was a fraud. I have nothing for you. Is that a little scary? So I hope it is, because what it needs to do is it needs to stir our hearts and redirect our thinking and think, it really matters what I am on the inside. No matter what it looks like and what people are saying about me, what matters is that He is pleased. Whoa, that needs to be our motive. Okay, so you started and stopped, and I passed over you, Robert, and I'm sorry about that. Did you want to get in on this? Okay, and so I'll start with Rick, and I'm coming back over here. Go ahead, Rick. It is.
If you do something in secret, you then, that's a way to test your own motive. Because if you're willing to do it in secret and it doesn't bother you that it's in secret, maybe you're that's a good way to test yourself. Doesn't mean you have to, like you said, Ferris, admit that you have to be totally secret about everything. But I think sometimes we might not even realize our own motive.
So let me just, I haven't forgotten you. Let me just work that way a little bit. And ask, what does the Lord mean when He says to do it in secret, to do your giving in secret? Y'all do realize it's impossible to give your weekly contribution in secret. I mean, even if you do Zelle, someone knows, right? So are we doing contribution wrong because it's not secret? What does it mean?
It's not being done to please
men. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's not about methodology in how you give. It's about motive. It is impossible to do works of righteousness that other people won't see. That's Matthew 5:16. But it is possible to do those works of righteousness to please God and not to be seen by men. Does that make sense? So this isn't saying you can't ever do any giving without somebody seeing it, but that's not my goal. I think that's the point of it. All right, yes, sir.
Well,
Thank you for being patient with me.
So your motive is genuine. It's coming from the heart. And you do this deed. But it is seen by men because it's a public deed that's come, but it's come from the heart.
Yes.
You feel guilty when people praise you for it? Great lesson, David.
Let me say it a different way. I don't like guilty, but I do say be cautious when men.
Because it's a temptation.
Yes. That's exactly right. Let me add that I think in doing this, there is a worldview piece underneath all of this that is really important that I think we need to ponder. I don't think we talk enough about our worldview, those basic things we believe, how much they influence what we do. But underneath this is the belief that there is a God, a righteous God who delights in works of righteousness, who is watching and who sees what I'm doing and is pleased and rewards. And so sometimes I think we're pulled to the wrong motive because those foundation pieces are not rock solid. Think about that. If there really is a God who is seeing this and will reward me, why does anybody else matter? Right? And so I almost think sometimes we need to keep thinking about those stones in the foundation, these basic things we believe. Worldview is critical, and I think it's even at play here. I think when there's doubt and uncertainty about that, we're more tempted to buy into what men say about this. Yes, and now you want in.
Yeah, now I just want one more thing. So I think it's really advisable for us as Christians, we have to maintain an
doesn't mean it's true, but let me say what it does point up. Yeah. Well, and I think that needs to be a motivation for righteous living, knowing that you can have a failure that does permanent damage to people's impressions and to your reputation. And, you know, reputations are built over a lifetime and lost. Yes. And so I think that's a motivation for godly living. I can do something that will forever shade the way people look at me. Don't ask me if it's fair. It isn't. But goodness, folks, the world isn't fair, especially towards disciples. And so I think that's motivation for godly living, knowing this is what people are going to jump to. Well, he's just a hypocrite. That's all it is. And it's hard to change that impression because they're not going to come sit in Bible class and get straightened out on their view of that. Let me say one more quick thing about this giving business, and then we'll move on. I want to be sure we see ourselves here. And so one of the ways that I find myself exposed about this is when I'm disappointed in those moments I don't get the praise that I deserve. Have you ever fallen victim to that? Maybe you worked in some way or did some project and nobody noticed or called you out, praised you. You ever had that moment? Yes, I'm embarrassed. I've had that moment. Thought, man, I did all this work and no one noticed. And what's the pushback? What do you say to that? He did. And then the second question I have to ask myself is, and who did I do it for? Right? So there are some relevant challenges that come out of this for me and you. And one of them is, am I content with God seeing and Him getting the glory, and I'm just quietly working behind the scenes doing my thing? And the selfie generation, that's tough. All right, let's take a look at prayer and see what we have time to do with that. Not much. What do the hypocrites do when it comes to prayer? So, again, I don't know anything about Jewish praying customs for the first century. I had to go back and read some about that. And evidently, what's described here was a thing that they had appointed times where they stop and pray. And so, if you wanted people to notice what a great prayer you were, what would you do? Make sure that you were in a conspicuous spot. Ah, it's praying time. Let me go stand out here on the corner, so everyone will know what a great prayer I am. And so people would look and say, wow, look how great he is. What did God say about that? Same thing. What's that? You got everything, that's it. You better enjoy the praise of men, because that doesn't mean anything to God. So what does Jesus require of us? That was easy. Come on. Yeah, closet prayer. Closet prayer. Go in your closet and pray. The point being?
An humble prayer between you and God.
Yeah, you're not making a spectacle of yourself, right? This is not about me. This is about having conversation with God. Not about, well, let me ask you a question. Does that mean I shouldn't pray in a way that's seen? Is that even possible? I mean, I guess you can have closet prayer, but is it possible to only pray so that nobody else sees? How would you do congregational prayer? Yeah, you couldn't do that? Yeah, I'm always impressed with people who pray when they're in restaurants. Y'all ever seen someone else pray? I mean, I'm always with the group that's praying and everybody else is going, huh. But have you ever seen someone else pray? And how'd you feel about that? Yeah, you kind of want to go over and high-five them and say, yes, do that again. Good for you, right? We praise them. Yeah, that's okay, by the way.
We recently had our waiter pray with us.
How cool is that? Could you give us a name in the restaurant? I'm just kidding. Anyway. Yeah. So the point is about motive, not about correct method. Do we find ourselves here?
yeah,
very true. Can we be, I guess the question I'm asking is, you know, how can we be guilty of the thing that he's talking about here? And maybe one thing that will help us is to remember, don't limit the danger to prayer, right? Prayer's one example of what might be a lot of different ways we can fall victim to this. Is there a way in our devotion and worship that we might be guilty of just thinking about how we're seen and not how he sees?
I mean, I stopped being seen in college because people thought I was doing it for different... Now, I wasn't doing it for the wrong reasons, but people thought it, and that really weighed on me for a long time.
Yeah, I think, in fact, the better singer you are, the more that danger goes up of it being about, you know, especially...
I told you the other day, it doesn't work. I don't like people talking to me afterwards. The best thing you can hear is...
You're such a good song leader.
Yeah.
Right?
We worship today.
Right.
That's the best thing you can hear.
Well,
that's worked on your struggle.
Yeah.
But that was a struggle for a long time.
So really, in all these facets of worship, whether you think worship leaders leading prayers, or frankly, let me talk about this personally, as someone who teaches publicly, there is a trap for us. You don't think as Jeff and Randy and Hunter and I prepare, there isn't a piece of that in our thinking of how you will hear it and how you will respond. And I won't speak to the other guys, but a temptation, even in what we choose to talk about and how we choose to present it, a thought about how you will hear it and how it will be received. What will people say to me when they go out? Because I will tell you, I have had the Sunday where everybody just kind of walked out and gave me the look. Right? Right? It's way more fun when people come out and say, oh, it was great. That's a great. I've never heard a sermon that good in my whole life. No, nobody ever says that, but right? Yeah, David.
I'm conscious of that a lot myself, and as a person who will often praise a preacher or song or whatever, I on purpose use different terms, so I'll tell them how much it meant to me personally. I was so uplifted, or you have no idea how much I was affected by the words you have chose. It just, thank you, it really helped me. Instead of, oh man, you're so great, or that sermon was so great, I usually stay away from all that now.
Right.
And personalize it.
Right.
It probably helps the preacher and song leader to hear that anyway.
Well,
encouraging their motive over them, encouraging their
That's intriguing. That's almost something to think, to ponder in the way that we compliment people, is maybe to say something like, wow, that was I appreciate the effective way you packaged his message. Who's it about, right?
Or,
yeah, I appreciate how you helped us to worship together today, oriented more that way. Because, listen, worship is all becoming about performance. In fact, I'm not going to open this can of worms, but I'm just going to say this. That's kind of why I'm kind of an anti-clapping guy. I know there's a big controversy, especially between young and old, about clapping and worship. But clapping has classically been, for older people, a response to entertainment. And I think we got to be careful that we don't ever let worship become, you're up there performing. It was a great performance this morning. I feel this way every day.
It's like, wow, I've never knew that before. But I was at a restaurant, and we were walking out, and then beforehand, I noticed this young couple with the young children, and they prayed before the meal. And when I passed by them, I said, you guys, it's refreshing to see in public a young couple praying with their children at meal time.
Yeah.
You know, because I just feel like it needs to be encouraged.
Yeah. Greed. No, I think that's great. I think commending them is a good idea as well. It encourages them to persist in that. But again, what's the point we're coming back? What's the big idea at work in this point in the sermon? It is that even in the things we do that are right outwardly, there's still another layer to it. And that is what is the motive inwardly. It's possible to be doing all the right things outwardly, and yet God isn't pleased with us because inwardly it isn't devoted to a heart. It isn't coming from a heart devoted to Him. Does that make sense? And so I think that works all the way through this segment. Next week we're going to pick up at 19. Well, I may even come back and touch a little bit. There is this interesting thing going on with prayer in verse 7 that's kind of an outlier that may be worth a comment or two. And then we'll press on and think about our possession. So think about 19 through 34. We'll grab that segment next as we're about to wrap this baby up. So anyway, thank you for your help tonight. Appreciate the discussion.